You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in-depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. On October 8th, 1977, worshippers streamed out of a Midwestern synagogue after Sabbath services, unaware that only 100 yards away, an expert marksman and avowed racist, anti-Semite, and member of the Ku Klux Klan patiently awaited his hunting rifle at the ready. The shooter, a white supremacist named Joseph Paul Franklin, was responsible for a 3-year reign of terror across the United States, targeting African Americans, Jews, and interracial couples. Franklin was stealthy and frequently changed locations, allowing him to evade capture. And even when the authorities did catch up to him in Utah, he somehow managed to escape custody in the middle of a police interrogation. That's when the FBI brought in John Douglas, a pioneer in the field of criminal psychology and the founder of the Bureau's criminal profiling program, to help hunt this cold-blooded murderer. Now Douglas and his co-author Mark Olshaker write about it in a new book titled The Killer's Shadow: The FBI's Hunt for a White Supremacist Serial Killer. And today, I welcome this legendary criminal profiler to the show to talk about some of the 5,000 cases with which he's been involved and his chilling face-to-face encounters with the worst monsters in recent history, from Edmund Kemper to Ted Bundy. He reveals why he first began interviewing serial killers on his own without the FBI's knowledge, how he would prepare for these deeply disturbing meetings, and how he and his colleagues found commonalities that would help the FBI catch the most horrific murderers of our time. Then he shares how his first attempt at profiling a wanted fugitive was instrumental to the capture of the white supremacist serial killer Joseph Paul Franklin, and how the Franklin case marked a significant turning point in his own career. He discusses what Joseph Paul Franklin had in common with Charles Manson, why he shot and paralyzed Hustler founder Larry Flint, and why Douglas fears that social media has become a fertile breeding ground for killers just like him. Plus, John talks about the one murderer that continues to haunt him today and offers a psychological profile of the most famous serial killer of all, Jack the Ripper. Coming up with John Douglas in just a moment. Douglas is one of the foremost experts and investigators of criminal minds and motivations. The legendary FBI criminal profiler and veteran author of true crime books has spent over 25 years researching and culling the stories of America's most disturbing criminals. He has directly worked and or had overall supervision in over 5,000 violent crime cases over the past 48 years. He also inspired the Netflix series Mindhunter, and he's currently chairman of the board of the Cold Case Foundation. His latest book is called The Killer's Shadow: The FBI's Hunt for a White Supremacist Serial Killer. John Douglas, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Thank you very much.
Well, John, I've been fascinated by your work for years, as have many people. So I can't tell you what a thrill it is to be able to pick the mind of the mind hunter. Even if some listeners might not know your storied career, they probably know the Netflix series Mindhunter. That is pretty much directly based on your experience interviewing, profiling, and helping to catch serial killers, right?
Right. That's correct. And it's based on my first book was called Mindhunter when I retired from the FBI. And so the David Fincher, Charlize Theron, they ended up liking the book. It was about 8 years ago, actually. The book was bouncing around and then it was right up Fincher's alley. So he liked the book, but they give their own spin on it. And those who've read Mindhunter and see the show, they kind of Hollywoodize it, you know, quite a bit. And then and my character, who it's based on me, but he's not me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was much more assertive in that capacity. I was young like him. I was one of the youngest agents when I came back to the FBI Academy. I joined at 25, and when I bounced around Detroit and then Milwaukee office, picked up a couple of graduate degrees, then went back to the FBI Academy. And like in the show, I saw was that we had some great instructors, but they really didn't have the facts of the case, and they were being challenged in the classroom by police officers who worked the case. And I'm auditing the class because one day I'm going to be up there and I'm listening to this being challenged. Hey, a hand would go up and say, "Hey, Mr. So and so, I worked the case. You got your facts wrong, buddy." And I'm thinking, "Oh my gosh, so what can I do to accelerate?" All I wanted to be was a good instructor. I had no idea it would morph into this big thing here today, criminal profiling. And so that's when I decided, we used to call them road schools. Go out 2 weeks at a time. You go to LA, maybe for a week, then you go up to Boise, Idaho. You just bounce all over. And so I told my FBI partner, I said, let's go into the prisons. Why don't we talk to Manson? Let's talk to Ed Kemper and Richard Speck. We're going to be there. And that's how it started. Mm-hmm. What started as I became a very good instructor, but then the cases started rolling in. And then with the amount of cases, I no longer could be an instructor. I was full-time profiler.
And when you started going into prisons and interviewing killers and sort of trying to reverse engineer their crimes, had anyone ever done that kind of methodical psychological probing that you did?
No, it just seems so obvious. If I wanted to be a successful doctor, I would interview doctors who I believe are very, very successful, or successful podcasts. I've interviewed them, right? Yeah. So it just seems so obvious to me because the formula, it's not a great formula, but it's Y plus how equals who. And so when you're looking at an unsub case, you're trying to figure out the whys of the behavior of the why this victim, why was this victim in the case of murdered this way, and how was it done, and then you're trying to come up with an answer. Well, here we already know the who, so let's go ask them more of these other questions: the whys and the hows, pre-offense behavior, post-offense behavior. Was there a precipitating stressor that was on you at that time that caused you to decide on this particular night to go out and perpetrate this this crime? So those were the things. So it was just done informally, but then, like in the show Mindhunter, we had Dr. Ann Burgess from Boston College, who she's become a star up there because of the nurse. Actually, in the show, it's a psychologist. And the psychologist in the show, she was not that active. I mean, she's not going to tell me how to conduct an interrogation or an interview or my partner here. But she was the statistician. She was the one who sat down, her and her husband, with us and developed a 57-page computerized instrument with thousands of questions concerning the crime, the victims, and like I mentioned earlier, pre-offense, post-offense behavior, all this stuff. And then they crunch the data. This tells you, okay, this is a contract murder. These are the elements of the contract murder. This is typically the victim. This is typically the method of death, method of disposal, that sort of thing.
So when you would go into a room with a murderer, how did you mentally prepare for that kind of encounter? Or can you?
Well, yeah, you can. It's shocking at first, you know. It's shocking just going into the prison itself, and you know, you can't go in there armed or anything like that. But first thing we'd do, we'd go to the files, and we'd go look at all the files and go through the information that the prison has regarding the case, regarding possibly any treatment the guy may have had since he's been incarcerated. And then oftentimes we would know the case, you know, like Charles Manson, you know the case well enough. But unlike in the show, it's totally erroneous. We don't take notes. We did initially, but you don't take notes. You want to have eye contact. And because when you're writing notes and your head is down, the bad guys are saying, what are you doing? What are you writing down there? Who's going to see these notes of yours? And the same thing with the tape recorder. You know, they bring in this big boxy tape recorder in mine. We started with a cassette, and even that drove him nuts, people who we talked to. So we ditched it. Like now, I can't tell you how many producers have contacted me. We want the tapes. We want to do a show with all these tapes.
Those are probably worth a fortune.
There's no tapes. We don't have any tapes. So then when you get in there, you don't know what to expect. Like Ed Kemper, 6'9". I'm 6'2". And he comes walking in there and he dwarfs me. I mean, the guy is mammoth and size. And he sits down. And what you have to do is you want to have a conversation. You don't want to have an interview. And it's not an interrogation. And so you want to see, even they're asking you questions about yourself, your life, you know, bureau, whatever. And you get this relaxed atmosphere, and preferably, if we could do it, I would like to do interviews at nighttime, these conversations in prisons, if the prisons would allow us to do it. I just want to be very, very relaxed, low lighting, comfortable furniture.
Wow, it sounds like you're getting ready for a date.
You do. Even you think about the clothing. Yeah, the clothing. Because some you want to get dressed up in the FBI zoot suit, and then other times you just want to be casual, just a casual attire. And another reason you want to be casual, because the bad guys, if they see you coming in looking like an FBI agent, it surprised me, some of the prisons, how loose it is. The inmates are walking around. Here you are walking around some of these violent offenders. Yeah. So if anything, some of these prisoners, you want them to think you're an attorney, but you're a defense attorney. If you're a defense attorney, they love you. If you're a prosecutor, if you're an FBI agent, you know, you're dead.
So you mentioned Ed Kemper a moment ago, and I think he was the first or one of your first meetings with a serial killer. Let's use him as an example. How did you engineer the environment and the conversation so that he would want to open up to you?
So with Kemper, what I try to do, and with him and with others too, and it's amazing, is to take him back. And once I did it and got him relaxed, his IQ is about 100, it was 145, his IQ. I tell people that was a combined IQ of me and my partner when we were interviewing this guy. And the biggest thing with Kemper, unlike in the show, there were times with Kemper I had to say, shut the hell up, man, shut up. Will you just answer my question? I'm trying to get an answer to this question. But this is his greatest accomplishment in his life. And you got the CD on, and man, it's rolling. You want to keep going. And it was just surprising, too. No emotion regarding the killing of his mother, the killing of the college poet we killed, the killing of his grandparents. There was nothing. No emotion, whatsoever, from him. But we learned a lot from him. And we don't fill out that 57-page instrument in front of me. That's the other thing. Yeah. What we do is we fill out as much as we can do before the interview, then after the interview, we go to the motel, get a bottle of booze, and we drink, and we go through everything and recall of his response, the questions, the information.
And as I recall from the series Mindhunter, this all began as sort of a side project. At least in the beginning, the FBI hadn't sanctioned what you were doing. In fact, they didn't even know about it. So how did your bosses react when they found out?
So we did that, and then we got in trouble from the FBI when they found out we interviewed Kemper. What the hell are you doing interviewing him? Why are you interviewing him? Well, we're interviewing him because we teach criminal psychology at the FBI Academy to police from all over the world and FBI agents. It's going to make us, you know, good instructors. And so initially they didn't like it. Then we got a grant, and then with the grant, like in the show, then we had money from the National Institute of Justice to go out and conduct the interview. So we interviewed initially 36 serial killers.
Wow.
If our definition, the Bureau changed it today. Our definition was three or more victims over a period of time with a cooling off period in between each case. A mass murder would be three or more people at one time. And it could be more than one event. The person would kill two people here, go to another location, kill a couple of more. But it's a total, three to four people, and it's a mass murder.
And what are the commonalities in most serial killers?
There are commonalities, but some of the characteristics they have, other people have the characteristics and they won't turn out to be a killer. Like you'll have, the big thing is you, almost by exception, you have this dysfunctional family. Almost every one of them had this very dysfunctional family where there's abuse of some type, psychological abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, absent or passive father, and a mother who just would neglect them. And generally, most of them are average to even some above average, like temper, you know, in intelligence. You then begin to see early on this displacement of their anger, and it could be a bully or they could be bullied upon in school. Surprisingly, Kemper, 6'9", was bullied upon in school. The other thing that he did, we saw with our offenders, with animal cruelty. And that's a big one today. You know, if you have a school teacher, if you have a child in your neighborhood and who's torturing cats and dogs, I'm not talking about burning ants with a magnifying glass or something like that, but small animals, that's a pretty strong predictor. You better have some intervention with that, with that child. So Kemper had it. Kemper did that, buried cats alive, and then he, which was kept down in the basement, and where he then would get his sister's dolls and cut the heads and legs and arms off the dolls, something he would later do with his victims. So you see these types of crimes. Many of them, when you ask them what kind of profession they'd like to be in, it was police officer.
Power, huh?
Yeah, it's that power thing. Also, some like David Berkowitz, it was a religion, was to be like a minister, because there's a power to that too. There's control over the flock. And even as a counselor, someone would say, I'd like to be a counselor, same thing. Someone is spilling their guts, their intimate detail to you, and you have this kind of a power, over them. So we found that a lot to be true. The other thing is, it's based on fantasy. It's fantasy driven, in their minds. Some will say, how about pornography? Is pornography, like Bundy tried to use that right before execution. He was a reverend was speaking to him, and he jumped on board, believing that pornography was the cause. Reverend Dobbs, his name was.
Well, what do you think of that? I've often heard this argument that particularly aggressive pornography leads to violence against women. What do you think? Is there anything to that?
Pornography had nothing to do with Bundy. What it does, it fuels the fantasy, but it's not a cause and effect, the pornography, by itself. You have this fantasy, and then sometimes the fantasy, like the BTK strangler, Dennis Rader, who I interviewed, it starts off in drawings and writings. I mean, have these writings of his were very detailed of torture chambers and what he would want to do to, each of his victims. Then they reach a point. Some may just stay there, and they don't become a killer of anything. But with the ones we interviewed, they now take that step. It's no longer satisfying thinking about it, dreaming about it, writing about it. They take the effect. And so the crimes where they'll be perpetrated are going to be perpetrated in what we call the comfort zone. And the comfort zone is the area where either where they reside nearby, their residence, the victims are nearby, or where they're employed.
Okay, so they like to stay in their comfort zone, somewhere familiar where they sort of know the lay of the land, the streets, how to make a getaway, where they can hide and all that.
It's just like any, I used to work bank robberies too, and I would interview bank robbers. They don't go into a bank cold. they go there like the day before or so, that, just to check it out, to feel comfortable, you know, in that environment. And when you think about it, we all have comfort zones. We have a favorite bar, or we have a favorite place, a park we'd like to go, or by a river, you know, when we feel comfortable. So they will perpetrate the crime. And how law enforcement, how we kind of screw things up, and we don't start linking cases, we call it linkage blindness, I should say, is that if you try to link cases by modus operandi, you're gonna miss out here because the MO changes. The MO is learned behavior, and the MO will develop as and be perfected as they go along. What we try to link, what we look for, is signature. And the signature in the crime, that is something that is a ritual that is done.
Wow.
And that is unnecessary to perpetrate the crime.
Now, you mentioned that one thing that most or all of them have in common is these horribly abusive childhoods. And, you know, I have no idea how I would react if I had been traumatized to the degree that some of these people had been. You know, I like to think that I would never kill someone, but I don't know that if I had been abused for years and years and was so broken as a person that I might not snap and take it out on others. I honestly don't know that.
You know, Ben, what could happen though, Ben? You may not. Yeah, you may not. But you could possibly internalize it. Mm-hmm. You see, and women are more prone to that. Women are not this predatory type of offender. Internalize it, and they beat themselves up. And you have a male the same way. They'll turn to drugs, turn to alcohol, turn the ultimate death is to commit suicide. So they beat themselves up that way. They'll have psychological issues, you know, as well. But again, the people I talk to over the years have psychological issues. The answer is yes. Do they know the nature and consequences of their actions? Do they know right from wrong? Yes, to both of those. They knew right from wrong, they committed insane acts. When you look at it, you say, "My God, this is barbaric." So you always will find that kind of defense, when a defense attorney represents someone like that. But what you have to show when you're coaching, say, the prosecution, is just to show the thought that went into it, the pre-defense behavior, the post-defense behavior. Did he develop an alibi? You know, did he clean up the crime scene or attempt to clean up the crime scene? You know, those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So you show that there was planning and intent behind it. Interesting.
Yeah, that's right. I did that a lot with attorneys, because the attorneys don't teach that necessarily in law school. They'll go through moot court and things. But as far as behavior, I wish this is season three, and they follow up on the Atlanta child killings, because I coached the prosecution in real life, knowing that Williams would take the stand. Mm-hmm. That I then took one of the attorneys, Jack Mallard. Was kind of a good old Southern boy, and gave him ideas on how to break down Williams on the stand, and we did that, and it worked, and he went crazy on the stand. He got up and the jurors are looking at him, and he's pointing his finger at me. I know you got that FBI profile over there, and you're trying to get me to fit it, but it doesn't fit me. Oh, really? It fits you perfectly. You know, sit down. It fits you. You know, the jurors are watching with their mouths gaping. Oh. Gave him open and holy mackerel, this guy. He looked like the Pillsbury Doughboy, you know, for the last several weeks. But now look at him, man, it's crazy.
Wow. Yeah. Have you ever encountered someone where you couldn't find some kind of underlying issue and you just thought to yourself, gosh, this guy was just born evil?
Yeah, let me think here. No, every one of them, I mean, has something in the background. You have to find it. You have to dig. I'm thinking right now, I just don't see. But the violent, predatory types, it's a certain, you know, breed of cat that'll perpetrate, you know, those crimes. But I really haven't. I haven't really.
Have you ever encountered a serial killer who seemed to express genuine remorse for their crimes? And did you believe them?
That's a good one. Let me see. Joseph Paul Franklin, who I wrote this current book about, certainly, you know, did not. Kemper did not. You know, Manson, of course, he said he didn't kill anybody. He never was proven to kill anybody. Mm-hmm. But of some of the only time one, and I knew, but he was pulling the wool over my eyes.
Really?
I was with a woman agent. Her name was Mary Ellen O'Toole. And we were interviewing a guy named Bittaker. Bittaker. His nickname in prison was Pliers Bittaker. And him and another guy named Norris were convicted rapists. And while in prison, they would get together. When he got out, eventually, they were going to kill a teenager for every year of a teenager's life, and starting 13, go right to 19 years of age. And they got out of prison, and they're in the L.A. area, and they get a van, and they called it a murder Mac, and they insulated the interior of the van. So once they got the victim in there, no one could hear any of the screams. And they call them Pliers Bittaker because they used pliers and they used hammers. And what made it upsetting to me, and I've got to interview this guy, but was that the audio taped it. And I have the audio tapes of this. As a matter of fact, when Scott Glenn in Silence of the Lambs portrayed me and portrayed my character, you know, I was working, and our offices were like the show, 60 feet underground. We would tell everyone we were 10 times deeper than dead people, 60 feet underground. And so when they saw how depressing our space was down there, but you want to walk in my shoes, Scott? I want to learn everything and play this part. I made him listen to it. And here's a guy, he was living in Idaho and very, very liberal, death penalty. And when he heard this, he welled up with tears. He said, and I only played a few seconds of it. You can't take it, man. It's disgusting. And he said, I didn't realize there were people out there that would perpetrate crimes like that. And I said, well, there are, Scott, there are crimes and there are people who perpetrate these crimes. And we have to deal with this every day. So that's why it's a concern to all of us while you're making, all you're making is movie Silence of the Lambs, that you're portraying us correctly. We are under a tremendous amount of stress. Mm-hmm. He got real angry with me later on. I saw an interview he did, and he talked about me playing those tapes for him. And he said, the next day I saw Douglas walking down the halls at the FBI Academy. And I wanted to go up and kick his ass, but put me through that, that tape. But that's just that's what it's about. Yeah. That's you want to learn. You want to play the part of somebody if that's the way it is. Yeah. The actors of Jonathan Groff and Holt McCallany, they did. They understudied us.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the death penalty a second ago, and I'd be curious to hear where you stand on that, because killers aren't much use to you as a resource if they're dead. But then again, you probably know better than anyone how horrific and remorseless they are.
I think you certainly need it in certain crimes. I think it should definitely have it for cop killing. They should have it for if you kill a correctional officer. I mean, walk in the shoes of a correctional officer in these prisons, violent prisons, violent environment. And you get a guy, the maximum sentence is life without parole. He has nothing to lose, and it's extremely dangerous, and it's extremely violent. And the guards are attacked, on occasion. Mm-hmm. And some of these crimes, like the Joseph Paul Franklin case, I mean, killing Jews and killing interracial couples. I mean, he deserved it. Mm-hmm. He got executed in 2013, and after talking with him, with the Secret Service agent, if you ask me. Volunteered to pull a switch, I would have done it. While during the interview, I was his big buddy because I'm trying to get information. We're trying to learn. We were doing assassination research, meaning the Secret Service agent at the time. But it bothers me. There's one nothing better. It just bothers me when I see cases where it's based strictly, on eyewitness testimony or things like that, or circumstantial evidence. Now you're going to throw this death penalty on there, and we're seeing too many of these wrongful, convictions. We have several here. I'm in Virginia, several in the state here, where this one cop, known to get 90% of his confessions from, they bring in this guy. He's the big, big gun. He's in prison right now because how he mishandled the interrogations and took advantage of people who are mentally ill, taking advantage of people who are young. And got them to confess to a crime. People don't understand that people confess to a crime they didn't even do. They just want to get out of it. They just want it to end. And hopefully my attorneys will take care of it. Well, sorry, Charlie. You already gave a confession. It's on tape, or you wrote something out to this cop, and now you got to spend the rest of your life in prison. So
yeah,
it's if that was kind of cases, it bothers me for sure.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Let's talk about your latest book, The Killer's Shadow. As you already mentioned, it's the account of the killing spree and the subsequent hunt for the white supremacist serial killer, who you think was probably behind at least 20 murders. Tell us about him.
Joseph Paul Franklin was raised in Mobile, Alabama. Typical background. A father who was abusive to him, alcoholic, would leave for long periods of time, then left with the mother, who's abusive, alcoholic. And he had three other siblings in the family, a brother and two girls, but he would always get the worst of it. What's interesting about him is that that in very early age, he was playing with a shade, a window shade, and with his brother, and there was a spring inside the shade that popped out and struck him in the eye, his right eye. Look at what happens next. He becomes a sniper with one eye, overcompensating for the loss of an eye. He becomes a sniper. And what really disturbed him when we did the interview is the mother. That's why he hated, just hated the mother. The mother takes him to the hospital for treatment. And the emergency room doctor says that we'll take care of things now, but bring him back in a couple of months and we'll correct his vision. The mother never took him back. When he finally went back to the hospital, he lost the sight of that eye. And to the day when we were interviewing, he's still angry as hell about that. But now he drops out of high school, 17. He marries a 16-year-old, divorces her after 4 months. Now he's looking for some kind of identity. He's inadequate, loser, type, down and out. And he finds the KKK. He finds the American Nazi Party, these organizations. And he starts passing out literature, and go to a meetings. And these meetings would be in basements or somebody's house. So he joins the groups, but he soon realizes, because he's a little paranoid too, and he sees that there a lot of the members are being arrested on occasion because we have infiltrated the FBI through sources. We have infiltrated these organizations back then. So he becomes what we call today is the lone wolf. He breaks away from the organization, and first thing he does is he goes up to, he's up in Maryland, he's tailing interracial couples, and this one particular couple, he's tailing them, they stop the car, what's going on, he goes up to him, he maces them, and takes off. That'll be the last time he uses mace. After that, he will stay strictly to, he can make bombs. He was a prolific bank robber. He was an outstanding shot and took pride in his shooting ability. And now he'd go on the hunt. And anyone could be a victim. If you are a white person with a black, with a person, a minority, if you are leaving a synagogue, which he killed a man, he shot a bunch of people for killing one, leaving a synagogue in Missouri, that would be the case that they would use to convict him and he received the death penalty, on that case. Pretty much that's how it all started, and it made it extremely difficult for the investigation. I was brought into the case because the head of the Civil Rights Division, Paul, I knew we were together on a SWAT team in Milwaukee Division. He knew I was doing this research, and he said, "John, you think you can help us out with this case? We know you're doing this other, you think there'll be any similarities?" And so I said, "I don't know." I said, "Let me go up to headquarters, get the material, take it back down to Quantico, and go through everything. Okay, you got 24 hours to come up with a profile because we know who it is now." Up to this point, we didn't know until he was arrested in Kentucky, and the cases that were linked together. It was Joseph Paul Franklin. They put him on the top 10. No one knows where he is. So I got to determine where we should put our resources in the United States.
Prior to you coming on board, how much of the difficulty, I suppose, from a profiler's perspective, would have been just the fact that he had quit the neo-Nazis and other white supremacist groups? So it's not like he was a name on a list of angry racists right, somewhere. Plus, I think that you said in the book that he didn't entirely fit the stereotype of what we think of as the racist redneck. You know, he ate health food and he exercised, for one thing.
Right. No, you're exactly right. And if those cases were given to me, those 20 cases, I wouldn't be able to say they were all linked together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have the victims. There's similarity in victims, but they're spread all over the country. And this guy's traveling all over. He changes weapons, even ballistically. It's not always going to be the same weapon. And he shaves off the ID. He even leaves the weapon at the scene of many of the crimes. And so it would have been extremely difficult.
And it sounds similar to the case with Ted Bundy, where it's all the more difficult because he was traveling all over the place. And back then, there wasn't nearly as much coordination and cooperation between law enforcement agencies in different jurisdictions.
It's better today. It's not 100% improvement. But there are over 17,000 law enforcement agencies in the United States. 17,000. I mean, they're not always sharing information. And back then, we didn't have the computer systems or anything like that. We had teletypes. We sent out teletypes. And so we had nothing like that. Today, we have the computer systems. But you'll still see cases where they're not sharing. The locals will not share with the state police. State police may not share with federal or whatever. They may not even share with adjoining counties to let the adjoining county know, hey, we got this a rape case. And we understand you have a rape case. Maybe it's the same guy. So it makes it extremely difficult. But you're exactly right. And today, I mean, there are hundreds of these hate groups on the internet. And the Bureau can't be watching all these. The Bureau's emphasis after 9/11 was international terrorism. We don't have, you know, you only have so many agents. And we have over 300 different violations we're supposed to investigate. So it makes it difficult. You have to rely on sources of information.
I mean, one thing that's the common thread among serial killers is that they dehumanize their victim, you know, like Silence of the Lamb. It takes the lotion and it puts it in the basket and that sort of thing. But now we have entire groups promoting the dehumanization of other groups and using social media to amplify that message. So it seems to me that, you know, what used to be the lone nut hearing voices in his head, he's suddenly hearing real voices coming at him from every direction, reinforcing his worst instincts.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. And that's why they'll go on particular sites like that. And they feel inferior. They feel alienated. They'll join these different podcasts or whatever, these different websites, because they're talking their language. They're talking his language. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to belong to any kind of a group. And it's not to say not that everyone in these hate groups will go out and perpetrate the crime. We had marches here in Charlottesville, Virginia. You remember about 2000, a couple of years ago, 17, and marching there, white males chanting slogans from Nazi Germany. But then it was one guy jumps in a car and he mows through the crowd, killing one person there. Mm-hmm. So there's no way of preventing it, really. The question is, can you identify and maybe some of the characteristics and educate the public, and that now the public will then reach out anonymously, whatever, to the police or to some federal agency about someone who now has become obsessed with this hatred toward minorities. He's purchasing all kinds of weapons. He's getting information off websites on how to make a bomb and all of these different things. It's been a change in his personality, whatever. That would be a great lead. It'd be a great lead for law enforcement to intercede and see what's going on with this guy. But it's difficult. I mean, it's difficult to identify these people.
Yeah. With regard to the Franklin case, this was your first time profiling an actual fugitive, right? What did you write in your summary of that fugitive assessment?
Yeah, that's right. That was the first one. It really was the first Bureau case. And because the agent in headquarters said, "Hey, John, if you screw this one up, you could be working cattle rustling out in Butte, Montana. Forget about this profiling stuff." What I'm looking for is strengths and weaknesses. We all have strengths and weaknesses. And if you know what they are, vulnerabilities, you can take advantage of that. With him, his strengths are certainly the crimes that he had perpetrated. He was excellent bank robbery. He may go back to robbing banks. The city, though, will definitely be back in Mobile, even though he was all out in the Midwest and as far as California. Now that he's a top 10 fugitive, they're closing in, so he thinks. And so the teletype went out that he would be going to Mobile, Alabama, because he was very successful robbing banks there. And also he would go to blood banks as well. It's kind of weird. He can knock off a bank, get a few $1,000, but then you go to a blood bank to get $5 out of the blood bank.
And I believe it was at one of these blood banks where you guys finally caught up to him. How did that go down?
We saturated the area all the way deep south, all the way down to Florida, and gave mugshots of him. He had very distinct tattoos and identified those at these different blood banks. And here he comes walking into a blood bank in Florida. And the doctor there right away observes this and did a good job of keeping him there while they notified the FBI and they came over and made the arrest. And so it was that plus his daughter was the other accomplishment. Really? In fact, when I interviewed him 8 years later, he wanted me to put him in contact with his daughter. And I would never do that. So that was another big thing. He wanted to make contact with his wow. family down there.
He seems to have especially been triggered by the sight of any black man with a white woman. He murdered a number of interracial couples. Does that go back to any incident or maybe even a relationship in his past with a girlfriend who maybe dumped him for a black man or something like that? Could you ever figure that out?
I never, but that would be a good point. That could have happened to him. We see he would pick up hitchhikers and some of the hitchhikers he killed was female hitchhikers, and he would profile them and ask them questions. And this one girl he picked up, she said, I was telling about her trip to Jamaica and she met a black guy there and had a relationship. Bang, kills her. Another one talked about dating a black guy, and that would turn on her, killed her. Other ones would talk and he let him go. That's what he was looking for. And that's what drove him crazy with Larry Flint, Hustler Magazine. Yeah, nice. He's down going through a trial in, I think it was Georgia, and he happens to be down there, Franklin. He's tailing Larry Flint and his attorney. He knows where they go for lunch every day. He lucked out, he said. He found a building right across the street from the luncheonette where he went the night before, and he put his weapon there that he's going to use, and he had an open window, unoccupied. He said, "It was perfect, John." And here comes Larry Flint walking down the street with his attorney, and he has a .44 Magnum. Bam! Shoots Larry Flint in the back, paralyzing him for life. Survives though, and then he shoots all three shots his attorney, who survived his wounds as well. At the time, he was disappointed that he didn't kill him. But when we did an interview of him, or actually wasn't this was. A woman we saw do an interview with him. He actually could find it on YouTube. Just before he was executed, he really was glad he didn't kill Larry Flint, because Larry Flint was now against the death penalty. He did not want him to be killed. So now he's real chummy to Larry Flint because he doesn't want to see him being executed. So that was interesting. And then he also shot Vernon Jordan.
Right.
Civil rights
leader. He confessed
leader.
To those crimes, but he was never convicted that I'm aware of.
That's right. So, yeah.
But you believe him. You don't think he was just showing off or something. When
no, he did. And ballistics. Okay. They were able to put in there and everything. But no, they had enough. The one death penalty is all you needed. They didn't want to spend money. What they do is they find where they have the best case, and the strongest penalty. And that was the strongest penalty. It was in Missouri. And that's where they went. But he did the same thing. He saw Vernon Jordan. He's with this white woman. He knows the hotel where he's staying at. He set up across the street in the field. He had a fence there. He had a weapon. He left the weapon again, and then we'll go back. And then he waited. car pulls up in front of the hotel. Jordan gets out of the vehicle, goes to the trunk, and then he takes a shot from about 100 yards. I mean, and at nighttime, the bullet went through his back at about the size of like your pinky, the hole. Mm. When it came out of his chest, it was the size of your fist. It's amazing the doctor said that he survived that, that gunshot. Yeah. He missed all his vital organs.
Now, you call Franklin a mission-oriented killer. What was his mission?
It's kind of like the book, The Shadow, that he is casting the shadow that someone else will pick up the reins and follow suit, creating he wanted to create this race war. That's why when he heard, too, when I did the interview, that I interviewed Charles Manson, he really admired Charles Manson, because Manson was able to have this group of Manson family members to do his dirty deeds for him. And so he really admired them, would ask me questions about, about Manson. So that's what he was hoping would happen. And there's been cases since then. I mean, and there was a book called The Turner Diaries written by a guy named William Pierce, who dedicated the book to Franklin. And it was basically what, talking about in a fictionalized version, the crimes that what Franklin was perpetrating at that time.
I'm almost amazed that he lived to see the inside of an executioner's chamber, because prison is dominated by violent racial gangs. Wasn't he ever concerned that black gangs would target him? Or maybe, I don't know, on the flip side of that, maybe there were skinheads in prison who thought of him as some kind of a folk hero or something.
Well, that's right. If he could get with the right group, but he was afraid to go to Marion. When I interviewed him in Marion, he was, they already had him separated, because what happened was exactly what you just said then. He was attacked by black inmates there. He was stabbed 14 times, nearly killed him. So they, after that, they separated him. So when I talked to him, he was separated with other, different inmates where they weren't, he wasn't in any kind of danger. Donald Harvey, the guy I just mentioned to you a little while ago, he just was killed in prison about 2 years after I interviewed him. He was just ended a couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago. Other inmates killed him. Because he was killing elderly people, he was killing veterans. He worked in a veterans hospital, one of the hospitals. And then when he would apply to another hospital or a job, they would always give him a recommendation just to get rid of him, even though they were suspicious that there was a lot of people dying on his shift. They would move him on to to get him out of our hospital, let him go somewhere else.
Well, this is now, I think, your 18th book. I believe all or most of them have been bestsellers. And that's the big change from when you started out in the FBI, is we now have this explosion in the popularity of true crime books, shows, documentaries, podcasts. I wonder how you feel about that. I mean, it's one thing for you to obsess over brutal murders because it's your job and it's what you're good at. But suddenly now millions of everyday Americans watch, read, and listen to the details of gruesome murders for entertainment. What do you think about this whole phenomenon?
Well, people like this, interested by the topic. Plus, I do public speaking, although now COVID virus is no more public speaking. You'll do these crime conventions, whatever they call them. 80-90% are women in these groups. They're so into it. But because too, many of them, women are the victims of these crimes. So the ones that I've worked, the rape cases and the serial homicide cases, they want to know the why plus how the equals who. Who are these people? What makes them different than us? Can I spot anything? I'm in a dating service. I'm on Match.com, for example. And is there anything I should be looking for? And I tell them, I said, my mother, when she was alive, when I was a young kid, told my sister that when you start dating, always ask the man what his relationship is with his mother. And something, she was right. She was right about that. Because if this guy has a loving relationship with his mother, that'll spill over into him and how he feels, towards women himself. And she was pretty savvy. She was right about that.
Yeah, I want to go back to what you said about women who come up to you at these conferences and conventions. And in general, the demographic for true crime shows skews very heavily female. Yet, as you mentioned earlier, the vast majority of serial killers are men, not women. How do you explain that?
Yeah, a woman, when we do see them, it'll be more for criminal enterprise. It'll be for money, for insurance purposes. that type of thing. And method of death oftentimes more not than not is like poisoning. Mm-hmm. They'll use that. And then we see women in hospitals killing patients, and that's a whole other category. We have the hero type of nurse versus, in a hospital, who wants to basically save the day. And you have another type of nurse in there. It's like almost like doing it feels like they're doing a service. Like I interviewed a guy named Donald Harvey in the last book I did, Killer Across the Table. I did a bunch of interviews, but he killed 70-something hospital patients. And another guy, I mean, it was just, it was come see, come saw. I mean, it's no big deal. I mean, and he got away with these crimes and was telling me how easy it is to kill somebody in a hospital, and particularly people who have a severe illness to begin with, because they won't do an autopsy on these people when they die. So it's very, very, easy to do. But he had that background too, that guy of early childhood trauma. And I mentioned animal cruelty to him. And he said, well, yeah. I said, what did you do? He says, well, I was on this farm. We had chickens. I killed chickens and buried some alive. But also, I killed neighbors. You know, two cows. I killed the cows. I cut their throats. But that's all I did. That's all. Oh, really? That's all you did. You know. In fact, I did that interview for a television show, and the producer didn't like. He thought when I would do these interviews, people think I'm going to get in the face of a guy. I'm going to grab him by his neck or something like that. And so, like when Harvey said, "That's all," I said, "Well, that's more than most people, And with a smile on my face, but I'm trying to get information. I don't want, particularly you have a film crew, and they're all packed up, and you got all these the film crew there, and you get this guy angry at you, he's going to say, Warden, take me back to my cell." You can't stop him. I'm no longer an FBI agent. You can't stop him. And I can't say, "Warren, okay, let him go. Can I interview Joe Schmo now?" Well, you have to get permission. He has to want you to talk to him. You got to go through all those hurdles. Yeah. It makes it difficult.
Well, as we wind down here, of all the serial killers that you've sat across the table from, is there one in particular who haunts you the most?
Franklin. As a racist serial killer, it's just his attitude, and like he was like a hunter, killing. He was different. Now, of the sadistic type, I would go back to that guy Bittaker and Norris. Those two, the ones that really puzzled me, and he was arrested after I retired from the bureau, was the Green River murder case in Seattle, and that haunted me. It haunted me because I nearly died on the case. Those who read Mindhunter, they would see that I was so burned out in 1983. This case, all kinds of cases were coming in. The Tylenol case, the Unabomber case, the Atlanta child killings, Buffalo's 22 caliber killer, Robert Hansen up in Alaska, abducting women, flying them up into the wilderness and in an aircraft, landing in a frozen lake, and then he would release the women and hunt them down like wild animals and wow. kill about 14 or 15 women that way. And by the time I got to the Green River murder case, I was just so burned out, I had tremendous headaches, and my right temporal lobe. I said goodbye to my wife two times that day, and she knew something was wrong, with me. And I go out there. Headache. I tell the agents after I went before the task force, okay, tomorrow's Wednesday. I'll see you Friday. This is what you should do with the task force for the next couple of days. That night, I collapsed in my hotel room floor. I had a not disturb sign on my door. No one disturbed me. 3 days I was on that floor. When they kicked down the door on Friday, they got no response. When they were trying to call me and knocking on my door, they found me on the floor. I was in a coma. My body was in a frog-like position. When EMTs got there, my body's temperature ranged from 104 to 107. My right temporal lobe had split, cracked in my right side of my brain. causing paralysis. I was in a coma for a week, came out of the coma paralyzed, couldn't talk or anything. It would be like a stroke person, I guess, but this is from viral encephalitis. They would say my immune system was so low, and I was like experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder. I knew something was going to happen to me sooner than later. Just the nature of the work and the volume of the work. So I came back, it was Christmas time too, and came back, happened on December 1st. I got home just before Christmas and paralyzed and in a wheelchair. The children saw me, they were shocked. And every time I would go away after that, they would be really upset because I was traveling. I was traveling like a third of a year, 130, 150 days. I didn't even know where I was half the time. And you're not always welcome. Kind of like in the movies, Mindhunter. You're not, just because you're invited in doesn't mean they want you there. Mm-hmm. And like the chief of police, they want you there, sheriff, because he attended the FBI National Academy and he heard about this profile stuff. But you got to be working with the detectives. And quick times, I remember one that comes to mind is down Louisiana, and the sheriff was great to see us. But these detectives picked me up and two of my people with me. You could tell they didn't want us there. They didn't want us there working yeah. this case. So just a lot of stress. Yeah. So anything, it made me a good leader, because then I was watching after my own people who were under tremendous amount of stress, and they would get burned out. You get burned out about 5 years. Of my 25 years, 18 of it in the FBI was doing it. And I continued to do it after I left the Bureau, but I have control over my life since I left the Bureau.
So even though you're now retired from the Bureau, you still get other law enforcement agencies that ask you to help them out or profile a killer?
Yeah, and a lot of it I'll do pro bono, or I'll do it where they want to pay me, or they want me to be involved, testifying. I don't want to get through that traveling all over again. So I'll be the guy behind the scenes, helping them out and answering questions, if I can. Yeah. We have the FBI Academy today. The unit has grown tremendously. Now they have 5 units, but really I like my old unit. We had 43 people, a dozen profiles. The rest were like technicians. Mm-hmm. Secret Service was there. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms were there. But of those 12 agents, me 13, we work everything. They got separated. No, we work the arsons and bombings and kidnappings, product tampering, extortion cases, doing assessments, foreign counterintelligence. I mean, we did it all. Tremendous group. They're like, it'd be like coaching the New York Yankees or LA Dodgers. You got all these stars, but you got to take care of them because they're so good that you can get in trouble with your health. And a lot of them, we're a dying breed. I'm one of the last of the dinosaurs roaming this earth.
Well, John, I know you have to go. Real quickly, any theories on who Jack the Ripper was?
Oh, yeah. In 1988, with Peter Ustinov, actor Peter Ustinov, I did the 100-year anniversary of Jack the Ripper. They put me on a panel in L.A. It was like the same theater where they have the Oscars. Camera crews all over, audience. I had a panel with me of so-called ripperologists, these maniacs that's the only case they ever work in their life. And so we they sent me all the stuff from to boxes and boxes of stuff, and I wrote an analysis, and that's in the Black Museum, they say, over in England today. Right. And they locked me up with these ripperologists for like 3 days before the show, and by the time I got through them, they were all on my side, and the type of person, and was a guy named Kaminsky. If it's not him, it's someone just like him, his personality. And a lot of the ripperologists today have agreed with that, that type of, at least that type of personality was responsible. It wasn't royalty or anything,
Right. Like some of these theories are pretty out there.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's so many, so many books have been written, about it. And just, by the way, just the Yorkshire Ripper just died today. The Yorkshire Ripper.
Really?
Yeah, huh. And I was involved with that case.
No kidding.
Peripherally, because I was over there training. And I told them when I went over there, they sent in the guy who was in charge of the investigation. And we were in this pub in Bramshill Police Academy. And in comes, I told my partner, I said, I think that's the guy who's going to be, wants to talk to us. I said, but look at him. He's talking to some other detectives over there. And they're looking over our table and they're laughing. And look, he's not even carrying a package. He didn't bring a case file with him. So he comes over to me and he says, he starts talking in British accent, you know, and he says, well, you know, this is such a complicated case, you know. And I said, you know, don't worry, I don't care. I don't really care. I just assume you sit here and drink. I have nutcases in my life. So he ends up, I said, you don't, I see you didn't bring anything. You know, so what do you want from us? So he starts describing me. And I said, well, you know, don't have to describe anything, but I'll tell you one thing right now. The guy that you're playing this audio tape in your soccer stadiums all over the country, I've learned something from Dr. Murray Myron at Syracuse University called psycholinguistic analysis. And I've listened to that tape. And based upon the crime scene, too, that you have described how these crimes were perpetrated, that is not the Ripper. It isn't? No, that's not the Ripper. And today's, if you Google the Yorkshire Ripper case, you'll find this, that how they were ignoring evidence that were when they could have got Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, sooner than they did. They were talking about also today about playing that tape in all these stadiums, and it was totally a waste of time. Meanwhile, this guy's out killing. I think it was like 15 people. Peter Sutcliffe killed.
Well, once again, your book is called The Killer's Shadow, The FBI's Hunt for the White Supremacist Serial Killer. John Douglas, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Ben. It looks like you've done your homework, too. You had some good questions. Thank you.
Thanks again to John Douglas for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, The Killer's Shadow, The FBI's Hunt for a White Supremacist Serial Killer, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Learn more about John at mindhuntersinc.com and learn more about his organization, the Cold Case Foundation, at coldcasefoundation.org. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.